The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2014. Here now is books editor Claire Armitstead.
Hello and welcome to the third of our Edinburgh International Book Festival podcasts. I'm just out of chairing a session called Modernity and Massacre, No Small Subject, and it was addressed with huge brio by our two guests. Kader Abdollah is a Persian-Dutch writer who was born in Tehran but has lived in exile in the Netherlands since 1988. His latest novel, The King, is a fable of 19th century Iran. Mina Kandasamy is a poet and activist whose first novel, The Gypsy Goddess, is not actually about a gypsy goddess at all. It rejects any such romantic novelistic notion. Mina, would you read us a passage to explain?
Just because this is a novel set in rural India, do not expect a herd of buffalo to walk across every page for the sake of authenticity. Eager mothers who hold salt and dried red chilies and circle their hands over your head before asking you to spit into their palms three times to trick spirits of the evil eye into abandoning you have been held back at my behest because I do not want to lose you to nostalgia or exotica. The tinkling bells of bullocks could add music to these sentences, but they have been muted so that you can silently stalk the storyline. Comrade, let's get this clear. There are only two possible ways of going about this. If you are able to get your papers stamped in the right places, if you have purchased your tickets, I could take you to the village of Kilvenmani and let you immerse yourself in the lifestyle there. I could let you live with them through the seasons, teach you to whistle as you work alongside them in the rice fields in a half-hearted attempt to declass yourselves, hold your hand as you watch the sunset and call it spectacular every single time. Let you walk back home with my women. I could teach you what it means to winnow when the wind blows, how to sweep up the leftover grain on a threshing floor, how much the various measures hold, and how to walk with a bundle of firewood on your head. I could cook you gruel and watch you greedily relish it with raw onion. I could show you the sculpted shoulders of the working men. I could make you swoon at the sight of their sweat. I could make you listen to a grandmother's curse, a mother's lullabies, an aunt's dirges. I could ask the roving gypsy woman to tattoo your arms and your legs with an ink made from mother's milk. I could provide you the pleasure of being an economy class voyeur on this exotic time travel. And this would continue ad nauseum and you would be sick of the cloying sweetness. And chances are you would never learn. The only other way of doing this is the way I am doing it.
So this is not the story of a gypsy goddess. It is in fact the story of a massacre that happened in 1968 in Tamil Nadu, where your family are from. Yeah. And it was about land rights, about peasants' rights to actually have enough food to eat. Tell us why you decided to tell this story now.
There are two reasons why I chose to talk about the Kilvenmani massacre. And the first is because I was, you know, born and brought up in Chennai, and where my father made his home. He ran away to the city when he was a 22-year-old or something. But even if I have lived all my life in the city, I don't find it home. I cannot embrace it completely. And every time, like, you know, with my father's own experiences of life, he tells me, you never know what is hunger in childhood. You don't know what it means to grow up in an orphanage. You don't know what it means to go to a temple and sing devotional songs so that people will, you know, give you food. So, you know, for him, this whole extreme, you know, being landless, being abandoned by his own father. And one of the reasons why he says he left behind all this background and came to the city, he told me, was I used to look at all these landlords' big homes, the thousands of acres of land they would own, and they know I can never become one of them. So I thought the only way I have to do is to educate myself and run away. The fact that my father ran away, I think it's still a part of who I am and what I am, and I have to tell this story about what kind of life he was trying to escape, so that I make meaning of my own life for me. So that's one reason. And the other, second reason is, I think generally as a writer, it's very easy to fall into the traps of writing about, you know, things you know very well, this urban life, you know, going to London now and then, you know, the university campus, places that are, you know, safe places for you. But the whole idea of, you know, being very political, trying to talk about a chapter in Indian history that's not talked about, to talk about resistance of completely unlettered and very militant workers who are struggling for their rights, the militancy of women, I think that's very exciting for me. So this was something I naturally was very attracted to and decided to tell the story.
The voice in which that you read from is a voice of a journalist who's trying to make a sense of the massacre and to tell the story of it, which is incredibly difficult to do because 44 people died, including women and children, who were burnt in their own houses. You use a variety of different narrative styles. So you use the style of a Communist Party pamphlet. You use a landlord, one of the horrible Rachmanite, as we would say, landlords, who is justifying himself and trying to make petitions against the people. And you use lists as well. When you actually come to the massacre itself, it devolves into a single sentence, one long sentence of the horror of it, and then a list of all the people who have died. It's almost like an anti-novel, isn't it?
It is in many ways an anti-novel, and I think the thing is, when I sit down to write, and I also, you know, like every other novelist, I want to tell it in one story with one single protagonist and the same uniform perspective. That's my ideal ambition, you know. But the problem with a story like this is that you have to see, what did the police records say? You know, for the police, these were not real people. These were not, you know, militant farmers. For the police, it's just an itemized list of the corpses and what parts of the body they find. For the court, it's about trying to find an excuse every now and then to let out the landlord scot-free, so the court documents are fudged. And for the party, you know, it's not just an issue of rights, but it's also about trying to establish themselves, trying to appeal to a wider audience. And for the people, how do they, you know, make sense with it? So there are so many angles in the story, and you want to, you know, bring out everybody's voice. You want to bring out the best of your poetry. And I think I borrow some of this from the fact that I write poetry myself, because you would never write two poems in the same register, because you would be repeating yourself. And I think when poets read in public, they're always reading very, very different stuff. And I was like, why should a novel be, you know, the same tone? And why shouldn't the novel, you know, like step out of what was, you know, let's say the Victorian novel, or, you know, the uniform monotony, and let's break it up. And anything can be put into a novel. I mean, if you manage to do it cleverly, if you can pull off the stunt, let's try. And I think it's very experimental in that sense for me.
Now let's turn to Khadr Abdollah's very different novel. Here's a brief taster.
Once upon a time, there was a Persian prince who later on, after he had become king, went to visit Paris. While meeting with a group of French businessmen, he was introduced to the engineer, Gustave Eiffel. No one suggested they go and see the Great Iron Tower, however, since neither the city council nor the people of Paris were particularly happy with that useless pile of scrap. The prince's official name was Nasr Muhammad Fatali Muzaffar. These were the first names of his father, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, and his great-great-grandfather. His mother, Madolia, was a powerful woman. The prince had 374 brothers, for his father had married over 1,200 wives over the course of his long life, 1,235 to be exact. Tehran had become the capital of the country during the reign of the prince's grandfather. Before that, it had been a large village at the foot of the Alborz Mountains. In no time at all, it had grown into a city of magnificent palaces, with the bazaar at its vibrant heart. In the northern part of the city, there were princes living in exquisite country estates, while in the centre, wealthy merchants had built spacious houses for their large families. The rest of the inhabitants worked for the merchants in the bazaar, or they had little shops or workplaces where they busied themselves with handicrafts. There was also a mass of unemployed people who'd left their villages and come to Tehran to seek their fortune. At that time, Persia was bounded by Russia to the north and India to the east. To the south was the Persian Gulf, where the British sailed their big ships to India and back. The country was wedged between two great powers. Now that the old king was dead and a new king was about to ascend the throne, both Russia and England were trying to wrest some of the power for themselves.
Carter, I discovered in the signing queue how popular you are in Holland, even though you're relatively little known in the UK. Here's what some of your fans had to say.
My name's Philippa. I'm a master's student studying Islamic and Middle Eastern studies here at the University of Edinburgh. Well, I've known about Qadir Abdullah for years. I mean, I read his book, The House of the Mosque, very soon after it came out, and I remember being captivated by his rich use of language. And it's odd because Dutch is my first language and I'm not really fond of reading in Dutch. For some reason, it just doesn't really captivate me. But his approach to fiction in Dutch is just so different. And I don't know, for some reason, it really drew me to his books.
And we're surrounded by Abdullah fans. Here's another one. Who are you?
I'm Ellen Jorisch. I live in Switzerland. I'm Dutch born. And I've been reading his books right from the beginning. The very first ones, the funny ones with the funny Dutch, which he... And you could see how with every book, the language became better, fuller, more poetic.
This is a truly international audience we've had, and we've got somebody here from Italy.
Well, I'm quite new to Qadir Abdullah. I just discovered him in April. Since the month of April, I read already 5 books of him, and I really like the way he writes, and it's like someone is telling a story. So it's very, also in a way, simple to follow, and easy, and entertaining, and captivating. So,
The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
Carter, extraordinary though it sounds, you started writing in Dutch at a time when you barely knew how to speak the language, let alone write it.
First story I wrote with 700 words, but there were about 2,000 mistakes. I didn't write in Dutch, but I wrote in my own made Dutch.
You read out a fantastic autobiographical piece during the session in which you talked about being the son of a deaf mute. Is that literally the case?
Yeah, this is the case, yes. He was not able to read, he was not able to talk and to write. And he got me. I was powerful in the Persian language. I was really powerful. I knew everything in the Persian literature, you know. And suddenly I escaped out of the country, I came to the Netherlands, and I was not able to talk. The life put me in the same position as my father was.
You made 3 attempts to get to the States, and both times, all 3 times ended in disaster. Tell us about those.
It was not possible for me anymore to stay in Iran. I escaped because I was active in politics, active and writer. I was not able to publish my book anymore. And I have written a chapter about that. I can read it for you. When I went inside Istanbul in Turkey, I couldn't believe my eyes. There were more than 1 million Iranian people who lived just on the streets. It was a crazy situation. The most of the people had came in Turkey in an illegal way, and they had no passport, and the police arrested them to send them back. Everybody was looking for somebody to smuggle him or her out of the country. Everybody was looking for smugglers to help you to leave Turkey illegally. At that time, if you paid $10,000, they sent you to New York in 1 week. If you paid $7,000, they put you in 3 days in Paris or in London. If you paid $6,000, you were in 3 days in London, I told you. $5,000 to go to Berlin, $4,000 to Stockholm, $3,000, Copenhagen. $2,000, Belgium. But if you didn't have any money, they sent you to the Netherlands. 1.5 years later, I was standing in the rain, in the cold, and in the wind. Where? In Amsterdam. The next question, what does a Persian writer see during his first walk in Amsterdam? A Persian carpet shop. I went inside and I said, Salam alaikum. What brought you here? He asked. The wind brought me here, I answered. And what do you want to do in this country? I am going to write in Dutch. I want to be a Dutch writer, I said to the carpet seller as a silly boy who knew nothing of the world. Till 1 hour ago, I didn't know where the Netherlands was, and I still didn't know even one Dutch word. The carpet seller told me in an ironic tone, your dream is very big, but the Netherlands is very small. Your big dream doesn't fit in it. Leave this kingdom before it gets too late. I listened to the carpet seller. After a couple of months, I bought a fake passport and I let myself get smuggled. But where to go? To America, of course. I got arrested in Amsterdam airport and they sent me back home. I bought another fake passport and I let myself get smuggled out of the country. But where to go? To America, of course. But they arrested me again in Amsterdam airport and they sent me back home to Netherlands. I bought for the third time a fake passport and I let myself get smuggled. But where did I want to go? To New York, of course. And I flew over the ocean and I landed in New York and I walked with my passport in my hand to the American passport control. The man looked at my passport. The man looked in my eyes. He looked at the passport. He looked at me, at the passport, at me, and I got arrested. They put my head in the American computer and they sent me back to the Netherlands. Once back at Amsterdam airport, I realized that I have done everything to escape my destiny. At that moment, I remembered an old Persian saying, if you have flown till three times, but it hasn't worked, change your writing language. But it was not an old Persian saying. I made it by myself and I started writing in Dutch.
Well, what a fantastic way to tell your story. And this is actually your story.
It's not a story. It is my life.
This is your life. But what is so great about that anecdote is that it demonstrates your writing style. And in The King, you've told a fable and you've modelled it on a 1,000-year-old Persian epic, a famous Persian epic. But it's a story about colonialism and about how Iran, or Persia, as you would call it, struggled to keep its identity and its integrity with Russia on its doorstep and the English putting telegraph wires across the country. Very modern story in a way.
Very modern story, because I had lost everything. Because after 25 years, the Dutch language had colonized me as a writer. And I tried to get something back of myself. And The King is one of them.
Meena, do you feel you're colonized? You write in English and you're Indian and you were not allowed to write in the language that your parents spoke. at school. You were educated in Hindi and English, weren't you?
It's a problem with, I think, the educational system itself, because I went to a school where it was run by the central government. It was one of the cheapest schools that you could easily afford. My father was out of a job at the time, so my mother was supporting the family, so it was very subsidized education. But they were teaching us English and Hindi. And Hindi is a language that nobody speaks in the state where I am from. It's a very North Indian language, and I'm from the southernmost part of the country, so I never spoke a word of that. I wanted to write to say many things about myself, about life, and for me, the only language I knew that I could actually use was English, because I spoke Tamil at home. I still only speak Tamil with my parents. My father doesn't read English. He doesn't read my books unless, you know, he uses a dictionary and he looks for words. So the thing is, for me, I couldn't write in that language because I was not educated. I didn't know much of the classic literary tradition. This, we are talking about Tamil, which has a 2,000-year-old history of Sangam poetry, of extremely beautiful culture, and you know, a language that still retains all of its charm. But because I didn't study the literary tradition, I was completely unsure of writing, you know. And the only language that I knew, that I had some idea about, that I could actually use, that I was taught this is right, this is wrong, was English. And so if I had to write, I had to write in English, and I was writing in English. So, but in other ways, it's also, you know, if I was writing in Tamil, I can never escape the shadow of my father. To everybody, I would just be this man's daughter. But in another language, I completely remake myself. I'm another person. I can, you know, be outrageous. I can be audacious. I can, you know, write, you know, poetry that is very, very provocative. And I can escape. But if I was writing in my own language, I would be judged extremely harshly. And I think in that way, there is an escape.
And one of the things that comes through in your novel is you sort of rail against the traditional English, what one might call the 19th century inheritance of the novel, plot-driven, realist. You're sort of rattling the cages of the novel with what you're writing. So you're trying to reclaim it in the same way, in a way that Kader is reclaiming a novel that is able to be iterated in Dutch but actually relates to a Persian tradition.
For me, for instance, you know, with poetry at least, we had blank words, we have people like Allen Ginsberg, we have, you know, like people trying to, you know, fight at the form, and, you know, you have E.V.E. Cummings, who is trying to play with typography. So, you know, innovation by itself is the nature. The word, you know, in the English word novel itself means a different way of doing a thing. But somehow, you know, once people started doing it, we have established rules, and we have workshops, and we have writing courses, and so this is how you do, this is how you pick a single protagonist, this is how you decide whether you want a third person narrator or a first person narrator, this is how the story arc is going to be. At this number of pages you should have the tension, this page you should have the climax, and this page you should have the anticlimax. It's become like that, but it just totally lacks spontaneity. And also, for me, the thing is that even if I write in Tamil, you know, in English, I do a lot of my thinking, and my first immediate reaction is Tamil. So, you know, like, for instance, this novel incorporates a lot of my own language itself, and it incorporates ways of thinking. Like, if, for instance, you know, even starting to say the story, I always go back and, you know, use this one single form of, you know, once upon a time, in some village of some size, there lived an old woman, and I'm trying to say once upon a time, because that's how people would tell stories to their children, you know. Oru oorla, oru paatti irunaangala. I mean, like, you know, you start like that. So you're trying to, you know, like, take bits and pieces of your own culture and that narrative style, or the way in which people, women, for instance, in my culture would never talk about their sexual abuse, because if you were raped, it was an issue of shame. And so it was unsilenced. So how do you talk about the huge, massive exploitation that was carried out on the bodies of these lower caste and outcast women? So you have to speak about it through, you know, silences, through implied humiliation, but not in the direct sense in which you would ever use the way rape would be, you know, discussed in our culture, in the, let's say, the British culture. Or you have to bring your own sensibility into it, because there are things that you can talk about and things you wouldn't be able to talk about. For instance, like when I went and interviewed people in Kilvenmani, they would tell me Gopalakrishna Naidu, he was so horrible, and, you know, like, he did untold miseries to our women. And how does that frustration, the frustration of sexual oppression, come out, you have a village meeting in which women are the ones telling, goading the men, we are going to stand by the red flag. If you guys are, you know, going to give up, you are weak. We don't want weak men. We have to fight. And that anger of the women who are going and stopping tractors, that anger of the women who are fighting the landlords, the anger of the women who are, you know, striking, doing all this is a reaction to the kind of extreme sexual violence that's visited on them, which they don't address in the first person, but which, you know, finds its various outlets.
And of course, in the novel, it's women and children who are a lot of the people who get burnt in this massacre, people who are sort of innocent. Kada, there is no obvious overt anger in your novel, but it bubbles under all the time, doesn't it? In a way, the rape of Persia, and also the fact that the particular Shah that you pick on, was more obsessed with getting back a bit of Afghanistan than he was with protecting his own country or modernizing his own country.
I needed to write this to explain myself the situation now in Afghanistan, in Iran, and even in Egyptian, in Algeria, or other countries. This book is an answer to our question, why Egyptian? Why the Ayatollahs? It is about 100 years ago, 150 years ago, but it's about now. By this book, I try to understand what's happening now.
One of the fascinating things that came up in both these novels and came up very much in the talk is the role that technology plays. And in The King, the Shah tries to keep technology out.
The King came for the first time to London. And he saw for the first time the lamps, the light. And he asked the king of your kings to give him lights and lamps. And a British engineer came to Tehran, to the castle of the Shah, and the Shah said only lights and lamps for me, but not for the rest of the people. Because he knew, because the king in Iranian tradition is the shadow of God. And the king had understood if the people has lights and lamps and the light disappears, the shadow of the king.
Mina, you talked very eloquently about what railways had done, and you have a map of railways at the front of the book.
If you look at the Tanjore district, which is, you know, seen as the rice bowl or the granary of South India, and communism was really, really, you know, like growing here, was very powerful movement that united people, fought against untouchability, was asking for higher wages, and it was very, very active. But if you look at which are the villages that turned communist, these red villages, they're all villages that are on the railway tracks, you know, like 5 minutes, 10 minutes away from the railway track, because there was a kind of witch hunt. If anybody saw a communist in the village, you had to go and ring the temple bell so that the police would be alerted. So the only way in which the communists could come was, you know, in disguise. They used to call themselves UG, meaning underground. They would come in the nights, visit the, you know, the people who had gathered. They would act as if it's a literary club, or, you know, trying to teach them. And in the night, they would discuss all these ideas, how to plan the strike. And early in the morning, they would get away by the first train. So you see the complete map, and you have a map in the book as well, and you see how communism grows really along the railway tracks. And that's a beautiful story. And the same way, I think the other invention that played a huge role was the printing press, because people could, you know, like print posters, and the communists were doing it all the time. And they were making, you know, this was something, you know, a big affront to the pride of the landlords, because these were people who couldn't even speak against them. They were not allowed to reply back. You had to lower your eyes. You couldn't even meet the eye of the landlord. You had to look at your own feet when you spoke to them. But then you have these posters, and, you know, the whole village is up, you know, like with all these posters against these landlords talking about the outrage. And so finally the landlords themselves realized that for 10 rupees these people get so many pamphlets printed, and what do? They get so many posters against us. Where do we go and hide? So the wall becomes everybody's newspaper. It becomes the newspaper of the proletariat. And, you know, the printing press was one of the things that, you know, helps it. So in a way, yeah, technology, even if there are some places where people oppose technology, like tractors, for instance, because it takes away jobs, at the same time, people were also welcoming technology with open hands because of the power it gave them, especially communication.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When you need to know what's in the news, you turn to The Guardian. When you want to create something newsworthy, you turn to Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it easy to create your own professional website for your small business, online store, professional portfolio, or blog. Getting started takes only seconds. Just go to squarespace.com, and to support this podcast, use the offer code GUARDIAN to take 10% off.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.